Today is Thursday, according to my pillbox. And then suddenly we realize that the retreat, which looked endless, is suddenly almost over. And all our secret vows never to do it again suddenly are transformed into, I could do this forever. And each this practice has an organic nature about it. It seems to grow and flourish in an atmosphere of commitment and selflessness and friendship. I do need to just stop and give some business announcements while I'm at that point. There will be a precept ceremony tomorrow night. Anybody who is interested in making a more formal commitment to this kind of practice is welcome to mention it to me during interviews today. Without going into too much detail, usually we make it available to people who've done two retreats here, or perhaps a retreat with us elsewhere and then a full retreat here. And it's just a formal commitment. I think this afternoon, we'll come to details later, but there may be a kind of a opportunity to ask questions. And Teja Do Osho will answer them. Slow process of delegation is beginning. But essentially it's just the taking of what we call five embodiment precepts. They're quite traditional. And just as a sort of public commitment to this kind of practice and to the people who do it. And you'll get one of these small mini robes. Which we'll have to pay with your life. And we'll just then ask your support for our practice here. But if you have any questions, please raise them during interview. If you are interested, please raise them during interviews. If you have more general questions, Margie will answer them when we schedule some kind of question session. It strikes me that that may take place during the scheduled walk time. I'm not sure, there seems to be some differing opinion here. We'll sort that out, just by way of warning to the walk leader. man who waves the flag at the front of the line. Okay. So let me just read our weekly koan as a way of starting. Tsiming's old woman lived near the temple and no one could fathom her. Tsiming would go there whenever he had free time. One morning on a scheduled lecture day, the drum announcing the lecture failed to sound, even though breakfast had finished some time before. Yang Shui Fenghui, who was then the temple supervisor, asked one of the brothers why the drum hadn't sounded. "Because the abbot is away and hasn't returned," replied the brother. Yang Shui immediately went to the woman's house and looked inside. Tsiming was tending the hearth while the woman stirred rice gruel. "Today is lecture day and the assembly has been waiting a long time," said Yang Shui. "Why haven't you returned?" "If you can give me a turning phrase, I'll go back," replied Tsiming. "If not, then the whole lot of you can leave, to the east, west, or wherever you like." Yang Shui covered his head with his hat and walked several paces back toward the monastery. Very pleased, Tsiming returned with him to the temple. So we've been looking at that interesting story. And there have been wonderful answers, responses to it from everybody. Some have been quite eccentric, some have been very personal, some have been very clear, some have been very witty. And in doing the koan, we kind of see ourselves in each of the characters. So each of us is sometimes the kind of headmaster or headmistress. We carry great responsibility and someone lets us down and we stomp off and say, "Where have you been?" And everyone's been standing and they're tired and "Why haven't you come back?" And that sort of thing. Just the way it's put in the story, we can identify that sort of slightly complaining face-off, you know. It's relatively mild, of course, there, but it's the kind of finger-wagging, you know, "You've let us down, we are the victims, poor monks, you know, poor us, why are you like you are, you know, what excuse do you have?" It's a fearful place to be, but I think we all know. And in looking at the koan, we recognize that part of ourselves. And how do we practice with that? How do we look at that in a kind of a compassionate and tender way? Sort of shaking our head at ourselves. And it, anyway, so that's part of it. And then sometimes we're the person who makes a mistake and somehow has to put it right. Somehow we've let ourselves or someone else or the world down, and we need to look at that. How do we look at that? How do we really look at that? Our tendency, of course, is to look away or to put someone else in the blame seat. How do we respond? And we haven't really done that, but one of the questions we could easily ask ourselves is how we would respond as the Zen master. Now in this case, he seems to be quite belligerent. And looking at the story again, it seems to me that he sees the finger-wagging head monk is not that clear himself. So he then steps up as a Zen master, as a teacher, and really compels the head monk to become clear, which he does. And then the Zen master can go with it. But there are all manner of possibilities, like every situation has. Oh, I made a mistake. Thank you for calling me. Let's go. Whatever. And then there's the sort of figure in the shadows of the story, the woman that nobody could fathom. And that's what we're kind of looking at today. And one answer that appeared during the questions about if you were the head monk, what turning phrase would you give, was in fact to include the woman, the unfathomable woman. Come to the lecture. Come with us. Which was lovely, sort of broaden things out. And the unfathomable woman in this case is also part of us. This kind of instinctive, slightly unknown quality that we all have. The quality of wholeness, maybe. Someone who's not involved in this quite detailed interaction between the head monk and the teacher. Someone who is able to somehow get in touch with everybody in that situation. Almost a kind of a trickster quality as well, but always unstated, always in the background, by definition, always in the background. But just being able to kind of contain whatever else is happening within herself or within himself. And in one sense, this is what our practice is about. Not just the various roles we have in a sort of, well, perhaps like, so this is all a little psychological, so forgive me, especially the professionals among you. You know, these different roles that we play and different aspects of ourselves that we deal with, but also this kind of shadow, I have various names for it, consciousness, that can only appear once all the sort of jittery activity of our ego selves and our limited perspectives, once that quietens down. Only then do we notice the person in the corner quietly going about their business. Ready, receptive, instinctive, and slightly threatening, to that, to any limited point of view. And creative, of course, creative. All those kinds of qualities. Which makes the whole sort of inquiry or investigation into the story something very rich. And it's very easy to kind of flatten koans and come to conclusions about them and either romanticize them or just psychologize them or whatever it is. But my experience is that they always kind of upend me when I do that. They always show me something new, something previously hidden to me. What's also of interest to me in the story is that however eccentric the behavior of, in this case, Tsiming, the Zen master, is, and there are a number of koans involving him, and this is one of the milder ones. anyway. It's always against a background of very committed formal monastic practice. That although the stories are memorable, perhaps exactly because they are happening outside or on the periphery of that, or almost against the grain of the formal practice, Tsiming is a man who's given his whole life to getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, chanting, sitting, working, studying, teaching, day after day, year after year. And there are also then the monks on the hill who are the backdrop for this whole story, who are themselves just getting on as we are, formal practice, sitting, working, eating, in a very undramatic, unromantic way, if you like. So the kind of call it Beat Zen, that was very popular in the 1960s, of just eccentric behavior from beginning to end, is only taking one small part of this tradition. All of that happens against the background of great commitment to formal practice. And to the richness of that. The other thing that strikes me in the story as I look at it is that the practice in the story happens outside the Zendo. Outside the monastery. Although it's against that backdrop, it happens elsewhere. And we often have a sense, including on retreat, that we need to be ready for our practice. We need to be... People sometimes say, when my mind's quiet, I'll come and do a retreat. Well, yeah. And one often feels that about oneself. I should somehow be better. I should I should be more good. I should be more respectable. I should have a quieter mind. I should be a nicer person. I should be in a more peaceful relationship. I should, and then I'll be ready to take part in the retreat. But we practice in the midst of our suffering. That is what practice is. We don't somehow leave our life aside and enter a heavenly realm, as you all know for yourselves. In fact, in the Tibetan Wheel of Life, the heavenly realm is one of the sort of worlds of suffering, and it's a particularly nasty one because it's so seductive. Because once you're in there, you really don't want to leave. Anyway, that's just an aside. But so often we feel we can't practice because my relationship is not good, or I'm getting angry all the time, or I'm unhappy, or whatever it is. But it's that very suffering that we bring to this practice. We practice amid our suffering and our enlightenment. And we go beyond both. And particularly when things are difficult, whether individually or in a pair or in a group, the very fact that amidst that impossibility of whatever relationship you're having with yourself or with someone else, within that very cliff, to then step up and come and sit is a kind of unstated agreement to come and support each other. It's already going beyond whatever our particular difficulty is, stepping out of it for each other. And that's the model of how we deal with our lives, in ourselves, in our relationships. And that's truly wonderful. Great selflessness. Great friendship. Great putting down my life for ours. And it's then that we rediscover the kind of power of practicing together, of just sitting together, far away from the city lights, far away from any publicity, in the middle of nowhere, just in this way looking after each other. And sometimes when everything is falling apart, ourselves, our relationships, our families, our work, our society, our environment, this is all we have left. Thank you.